Good evening, friends. Welcome to Valley Writers Read. And so here we are, the very first program of a brand new year, 2013. And inasmuch as we're starting a brand new season, isn't this perhaps a good time to kind of remember who we are, where we live, and the kinds of things we do? And to help us do just that, to sort of start the new year off right, tonight we're really privileged to have one of our Valley's great authors, Mark Arax, introduce us to what really goes on in the San Joaquin Valley. He calls his story The Big Valley. Here he is, Mark Arax reading The Big Valley.
The Big Valley. I live in an old fig orchard in northwest Fresno, just off Forkner Avenue, a street named after the king of figs. My younger sister and brother live a mile or two down the road, and each of our houses sits within walking distance of where we grew up. When my father claimed our first piece of fig ground in 1968, and built a custom house with a swimming pool out back, it was easy to believe we were living on the far fringe of existence. I rode my mini bike through the figs that wrapped around our house and gigged for frogs in an irrigation canal that sliced through the neighbor's backyard. With one orchard stitched to the next, it was easy to lose your sense of geography and time. One afternoon, I ventured too far and got lost. It couldn't have been more than 3 or 4 miles, but it seemed as if I had found another world. The engine of my little Indian had overheated, and I was stuck in the mud, surrounded by hundreds of turkey vultures. They were the ugliest things I had ever seen, heads naked and wrinkled, and forenecks the color of blood. They looked hungry and determined, not the sort of beast I could frighten off with a dirt clod or a shout. I imagined all sorts of cruel ends. Luckily, my cousin Brian had been riding beside me on his motorbike and steered clear of the mud. Under the long eye of the buzzards, we hitched my bike to his and putt-putted home, taking in what remained of the fig empire that J.C. Forkner had built in the early 1900s. My grandfather arrived here when Forkner was still blasting 250,000 holes in the hard pan to plant his Kalmerna figs, a cross between the California and Smyrna varieties, the New World and the Old. "Boom, boom, that's all I heard," Grandpa told me. "Dynamite day and night. The whole Fresno. It was shaking." Henry Ford himself had come out to Forkner's fig gardens to watch his new tractors dig 25 miles of canals and level 12,000 acres of hog wallow. Never had so many Fordsons been assembled to work one piece of ground, our local history books crowed. My grandfather was a survivor of the Armenian Genocide, a young poet who took his pen name from the River Arax that came down from Mount Ararat. And he did what all young poets do when they find this new land. He fell to his knees and began picking. It took him 4 seasons tramping up and down the San Joaquin Valley to buy his first vineyard. My father grew up on that farm in West Fresno, left in 1950 to pursue a football scholarship at USC, and then he came back. By the time I was growing up, he ran a grocery store and then a bar. The only vineyard I knew was the one in a painting that hung above our adobe fireplace. Right next to the frame was a stain from a stick of butter my father threw at me in a fit of rage. He wasn't an easy man to figure. In the drawer, he kept a knife that looked different than every other knife. And when I asked him what it was for, he simply said, "Girdling grapes." Why he kept it there, what girdling even meant, were questions that didn't occur to me for another 20 years. By the time I learned that the curved double blade was used to cut gashes in the vine's outer wall, scars that kept nutrients from flowing down into the trunk where they were wasted. By that time, our world had changed. Men sharing my father's vision had bought up parcels all the way to the river. Today, the fig orchards of Northwest Fresno are gone, swallowed up by custom houses and tract houses, Walmarts and Targets, and so many fast food chains that when McDonald's wants to launch a new product nationwide, it does its first tests right here. People now talk about my part of Fresno as if it were the inner city. The transformation happened in half a lifetime. "Jojo," I tell my oldest boy, "I remember when all this was..." And then I catch myself, an old-timer at 40-something. Ah, let's go take some batting practice. The roots beneath the clay die hard. In early spring, they send up shoots through the crannies of my backyard. Up from the ivy and the bamboo come Forkner's old figs. I attack them with shovel and shear, out of suburban necessity, I imagine. But the milk they bleed, sticky white, causes me to wonder. And yet my death blow is something of a paradox, for I have turned large sections of flower bed and lawn into orchard and vegetable garden. Like my grandfather and father, I am a backyard farmer with too little land for my dreams. Enough dirt remains under my nails that I sometimes buttonhole real farmers with tales of how my 15 varieties of tomatoes keep producing through early December. I forego commercial fertilizers that cause the plant to leap out of spring and produce too many watery tomatoes too fast, only to peter out come summer. Instead, I use compost and rabbit droppings. I tell these farmers how my peppers do better in slightly heavier ground and my cucumbers in slightly lighter soil, requiring the creation of mini zones in a plot no bigger than 15 yards by 10 yards. Of course, the real farmer shoots back a smile that tells me I can't begin to understand how tortured is the logic that compares my backyard to his 1,000 acres. Still, I love mixing with the big boys to hear them whine about too much government intervention and too little government subsidies, about good weather producing surplus yields and low prices, and bad weather producing paltry yields and record prices. If I get up early enough, I can find them at the coffee shop comparing the size of their grapes like some boys compare their privates. But if you want the full treatment, to see them in all their beautiful pessimism and optimism, you wait until mid-February and head to Tulare, to the biggest farm equipment show in the world, even bigger than the one in Paris, France. From Fresno to Tulare is an hour's drive, and I gas up my Volvo and journey south on Highway 99. the flat four-lane that runs straight up the gut of the most productive farm region in the world. Highway 99 has been called our Mississippi, a tidewater of crops and campesinos. Every third vehicle that whooshes past the oleanders that divide the road is a big rig, and more often than not, they're hauling away some piece of the valley's lavish bounty. Summer here isn't measured by the calendar, but by the pick and pull and squeeze and crush of the unbroken harvest. It begins in April with the cherry and ends in November with the pomegranate. In between, we pull more milk from our cows than any other region in the country. The same with grapes, tomatoes, peaches, nectarines, plums, almonds, walnuts, pistachios, and olives. Maybe all kids are dumb to their place, but it hardly occurred to me back then when I was a child that we lived amid 7 million acres of farms from Bakersfield to Redding. Even surrounded by all those figs, we lived a decidedly suburban life. The country might as well have been an ocean away. So few times we touched it. The country, my mother would chant to my father, as if it were some elixir. Let's take a drive out in the country. It seemed that we were neither rural nor urban, but some fraudulent variant of the two. The bigness of valley agriculture only compounded the distance that separated suburbia from the farm. What we glimpsed on 99 on our way to Disneyland or Candlestick Park wasn't the prettified vineyards of Napa or the gentle wheat fields of the Midwest. Our valley had its own rusty, gnarled, corrugated, fermented beauty. Our farmers weren't farmers. They were growers. 10 minutes outside Fresno, the strip malls and gated communities give way to an open view, and I can make out the faint shoulders of the Sierra. Faint because we now live in the dirtiest air basin in the nation. Our 8-hour smog readings worse than even Los Angeles. As I head into Fowler, there's a parting in the oleanders as if some elephant is trampled across, and I grip the wheel tighter. Long stretches of 99 have no concrete or metal barrier separating southbound and northbound traffic. Truck drivers hauling one crop or another are sometimes too drunk or wired on crank to know that they've just crossed the oleander line. The pink flowers part. You never see them coming. A few miles past Selma, where the raisin capital of the world has thrown its lot to car dealers, a tractor clears another 80 acres of prime farmland. You can read what kind of year a farmer has had by looking at his fields in late winter. If he hasn't pruned his vines yet, you can bet he's had a tough year. A field cleared like this one sometimes means he can no longer turn a profit, and he's better off sitting on his dirt than growing raisins. If the banks are so inclined, a cleared field might mean he's pulling out grapes and putting in almonds. No such future awaits this field next to a Super K in the town of Kingsburg, which used to be quite content being known as the Little Swedish Village. This farmer has sold out to a developer. Hallelujah, say the wife and kids, so another big box might rise. I cross the Kings, which irrigates more farmland than any other river in the world, except for the Nile and Indus. In winter, with most permanent crops still in hibernation, there isn't much for the Kings to do. The river, too, falls asleep, bone dry for long stretches. The snowpack, its lifeblood, hangs heavy on the mountain. whatever snow has melted, waits behind Pine Flat Dam for the call of the irrigation pumps. This is not to say that winter's brown isn't a pretty time. The peach, nectarine, and plum trees have been pruned into V-shaped cups, their centers cleared of brush so they can drink the light. The vines, long canes clipped and tied to wire, won't bud for another month. Hemingway would love these fields. The sign up ahead reads Traver, but the town no longer exists. It shot up overnight in the late 1800s, a rollicking hamlet with 16 saloon keepers, 11 blacksmiths, one preacher, one teacher, two physicians, one undertaker, two whorehouses, one Chinese gambling den, two Chinese laundrymen, and a Mexican tamale maker named Jesus. Traver held the world record for the greatest amount of wheat shipped from a producing point during a single season. But as fast as it sprouted from the plains, Traver vanished in a cloud of alkali dust, its once fertile soil poisoned by salts bubbling up to the surface. The road gets wider and the fields flatter in Tulare County. No highway sign proclaims it, but this is the dairy capital of the world. Decades ago, Portuguese farmers from the Azores turned Merle-haggard country into a milk-producing, alfalfa-growing marvel. Now they've been joined by the Dutch families from Chino, who sold out their dairies to Southern California builders. Millionaires in their 50s, with nothing to do, the Dutch migrate a few hundred miles north to Tulare, building grand houses and even grander dairies. Trucks and more trucks. Silverados by the hundreds caked in mud. I count license plates from Arizona, Nevada, Oregon, Kansas, North and South Dakota, and Mississippi. The 2004 World Ag Expo boasts 2.5 million square feet of sold space, exhibits under tents and tin roofs, and outdoors on 7,000 cubic yards of bark. The February sun is strong, and so are the hats. "Screw farmers," one cap reads. Everyone else does. If you're queasy about Mad Cow, this isn't the place for lunch. Even the shish kebab barbecued by the Armenians is beef. I make my way to the big tractor display on the far side of the expo, and in no time find myself in the crossfire of a debate between Caterpillar and Michelin, with John Deere square in the middle. The topic? Which $260,000 tractor leaves the lightest footprint in the field? Every row crop farmer knows that one of the keys to good yields is to keep the soil airy and free from compaction. But with so much ripping and tilling to do, how do you prevent a tractor's tires from pressing down on the soil and nullifying your good work? A decade ago, at this same Ag Expo, Caterpillar announced the death of the round tire. It had borrowed an idea from the military and turned its tractors into tanks with rubber belts for wheels. No longer did an individual tire bite into the ground. Caterpillars were now powered by a moving track that dispersed the pounds per square inch across a long, wide belt. They called it flotation, a revolution in soil preparation. But the track must have hit rough ground along the way, because the tire, 6 feet tall and 1,074 pounds, is now front and center at this show. The big Michelin radial is being billed as the ultimate in feather light footprint. In terms of soil compaction, a large tire like this is better than the track, the Michelin man tells me. If you look at that caterpillar, the weight is not distributed evenly across the rubber belt. If you had to turn or go on hills, it ruts into the ground. This Michelin can run over your foot, and you almost won't feel it. Flotation, by the way, doesn't come cheap, costing $4,000 a tire. The caterpillar man, for his part, hands out a slick brochure on the new MT-700 series. Any bugs in the old track system have been ironed out over the years, he assures me. The MT-700 blends smooth power delivery and luxurious comfort with unmatched versatility and enduring caterpillar strength. What to do? So I give the boys from Waterloo, Iowa, wearing John Deere green, the last word, mostly because they build both kinds of tractors. It all depends on your soil, one John Deere guy explains. In the Mississippi Delta, where you work the ground wet, the track system wins out. But the tire manufacturers like Michelin have done a great job building big tires with radial technology. You can't beat them in most situations. I grab a chicken sandwich and find the tent that's pure carnival. Barbecue grills beside toe rings. Elegant jewelry by Kathy beside cinnamon glazed almonds. Good feet arch support beside Willie's gopher and squirrel bait. Calf growth formula gives calves more muscle than Arnold beside the California scarecrow. No cannons or shotguns, no netting or noise, just a good old-fashioned scarecrow powered by solar with battery backup. On the way out the ag show, I run into the Sarapian brothers, third-generation grape growers who farm 500 acres in the Lone Star District, east of Fresno. I went to Sunday school with both boys and watched from afar over the years as they struggled with the crankiness of the raisin market. Getting people to eat more sun-baked grapes wasn't easy. The riddle had once occupied the genius of William Saroyan, who mused in a short story that solving the raisin problem was no more complicated than getting every woman in China to place a single raisin in her pot of rice. Now the Chinese have dammed their own rivers and built a big valley that rivals our big valley. Grapes, apples, citrus, figs, stone fruits, and nuts. Their first full harvest looms just around the corner. The Sarabians, like others, are feeling the heat of a competitor with the same land, the same water, but vastly cheaper labor. The brothers have cleared out much of their vineyard land and planted vegetables in pluots, cross between a plum and an apricot, or so they say. This year's farm show is a chance to learn about irrigating onions, green beans, and cucumbers by drip. You stay with farming long enough, and you'll go full circle more than once, David Sarabian says, his chuckle ironic. What other choice do we have? Perhaps in time, a developer will come to their door and lay down another choice. For the time being, the Sarabians are still farmers. On the drive home, I think about my father and how things might have been different had he found a way to stay in farming. I like to believe he grew disillusioned with suburbia in the early 1970s. He turned his bar into a nightclub and brought in Chuck Berry and other big acts from the city. But it never seemed enough. Early one morning, I was awakened by the sound of shovels and hoes working the soil outside my bedroom window. If my father couldn't return to the farm, he was determined to bring a little farm to North Lafayette Street. He and Grandpa had cleared a quarter of the backyard and trucked in dirt from the river to add to the hard pan. The three of us spent that day planting tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, cucumbers, watermelons, cantaloupes, and squash. Maybe because the soil was virgin, or maybe because I followed so intently my grandfather's instructions. Irrigation is art, Marky. Not so much, not so little. But you should have seen that garden. From July to December, I picked baskets of red and green and purple vegetables and washed and polished each one. Grandpa said he had never seen such a bounty. Next year, he promised, would be even better. Then the first frost came, and the green leaves withered, and my father went to work one Sunday night and was shot and killed by two men. It would take more than 30 years for the police to find one of them. My mother didn't live to see the day. The trial left so many questions. Every year, when my wife isn't looking, I take out another strip of grass or dig another hole in the flower bed to plant my crops. A chocolate persimmon in 93, a muscat vine in 94, a suncress peach in 95, a black mission fig in 97, a mandarin citrus in 98, lemon boy tomatoes, Bulgarian tomatoes, Armenian eggplants, Japanese cucumbers. As another orchard gets plowed under out there, I plant another pomegranate or apricot tree back here. I know it's futile, but my garden is now ample and year-round, and the dirt under my nails is honest farm dirt. The country, as my mother used to call it, is right outside my window.
Thank you, Mark Irax, for such a unique view of the San Joaquin Valley, its basic agricultural roots, a lot of its history, its industry, and what's most important of all, its people. Mark takes us on a trip from Fresno to Tulare, past Selma, and Little Sweden, the nickname for Kingsburg. He explained how the earliest settlers blasted a quarter million holes through the hard pan just north of Fresno to sustain 12,000 acres of figs, which, of course, is how Fresno's famous fig garden got its name. He tells us about the grapes in Selma, about peaches, nectarines, and plums in Kingsburg, about dairy farmers in Tulare County, and gives us a good description about the super large agricultural exposition held in Tulare, where various farm equipment companies show off tractors that sell for better than $250,000. Why, sometimes a single tire goes for as much as $4,000. He tells us about an ongoing debate as to whether farmers should use tractors with huge tires or tractors that operate like military tanks, each side telling prospective buyers that their product will do the least harm to the soil they're trying to cultivate. He tells us about being an amateur gardener himself who plants and harvests classic vegetables and fruits from his own garden. And finally, Mark tells us a little about the untimely death of his father. It took 30 years to find the killer. All in all, Mark's story tonight is a wonderful introduction to the San Joaquin Valley, its people, its agriculture, and its lifestyle. And of course, on this show, we'll be hearing more and more about the valley and its people all year long. Friends, the story you heard tonight appeared in a collection of essays of 27 California writers entitled My California. Mark is a graduate of Fresno's Bullard High School and Fresno State University. He received his M.A. in journalism from Columbia University. His first book, In My Father's Name, was published to critical acclaim by Simon & Schuster. Then came The King of California, which he co-authored with Rick Wartzman. After listening to Mark's story tonight, we get the feeling that while he's indeed a fine writer, sometimes it seems as his heart may well be out there in that garden of his, planting, cultivating, irrigating, and best of all, harvesting his homegrown fruits and vegetables. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you would like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Hope Knisley. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.